right, so welcome everyone to the keynote address. We hope the panels that everyone attended were very engaging and stimulating. And now I'd like to introduce our keynote speaker for the day, Dr. Ann Hagel, who's program head at the Changing Adolescence Program at the Nuffield Foundation. Dr. Ann Hagel runs the Nuffield Foundation Initiative on Time Trends in Adolescent Mental Health. She is a chartered psychologist with specific interests in at-risk adolescents and has undertaken social policy research in both the UK and the US on a Fulbright scholarship. Ann is also a professional advisor to the Research and Practice Partnership Board, on the advisory board of the Association of Young People's Health, and a trustee of the Prison Reform Trust. Overall, she has authored or co-authored more than 60 articles, chapters, and reports on adolescence, including 3 books, and has been editor-in-chief of the Journal of Adolescence since 2000. Dr. Hagel's keynote address is titled, A Bit of Time Travel, Social Change for Adolescents in the UK Since the 1970s, and Some Thoughts About Adolescent Welfare. And now I gladly present Dr. Ann Hagel.
I was just saying to somebody at the tea break, there is nothing more intimidating than talking to a group of people who are like you, students in the middle of doing your studying. You're going to be very broad. You're going to have all sorts of different interests. You're, from my experience, far more engaged as an audience to talk to than a group of professionals from my own background. So I'm very intimidated up here. But what I wanted to talk to you about today was the possibility of links between social context, and by that I mean the way that we structure the world for young people. So this is sort of about what we do to them, how we organise our societies and their lives, effectively. The links between that and well-being. And then at the end, I'm going to make a slight jump into welfare and draw some links between well-being and welfare. I should say I've just sat through one of the panel discussions, I'm going to say to you, I'm a jobbing researcher. I'm not a theoretical, analyst. You're not going to get a big theory about social context and social structure here. This is a practical sort of presentation. I'm not an academic. I haven't been an academic for a very, very long time. So a few scene-setting thoughts at the outset, and I did want to just stress, and I'm going to talk about adolescence, and how much adolescents' lives are shaped by the social context in which they live. So there are a number of key social institutions that just structure and dominate their lives, much more perhaps than structures dominate our lives 10 years later, and in a different way to how they structure your life 10 years before. And I'm thinking of things like education, family, part-time employment, beginning to be engaged with some of those ways of spending your time. It is an intensely social time of life, and somebody, Heather, who was chairing the panel I was in just before tea, made this point, actually. She mentioned that there isn't a child without an adult in some way. I'm going to emphasise that, but also friends, peers, classmates, extended family, teachers, neighbourhood groups. All of this, an adolescent's life is social. That's pretty much how you define it. And there are pressures and expectations that arise from several directions at once because of that. And although we are here in the UK and in the Western world more healthy, wealthy and comfortable than we have been at any time in the past, British teenagers are undoubtedly subject to a range of stresses. And part of what I want to look at is whether those have increased. And in fact, the general well-being of British adolescents has been the topic of considerable debate in the press here in recent years. This is a focus on developed countries. It's a focus on the UK. And the issues and a lot of the papers that you're going to hear of today and tomorrow are very different from that. But I hope in some way some of the underlying notions are things that you can take and apply to children in different contexts. But the issues will obviously be completely different in low- and middle-income countries. So I'm going to start with 3 questions. I'm going to start by seeing if I can work this thing. That's the title. So there are my 3 questions. What information do we have about social change for this age group? What key social structural changes have taken place in some key domain over the last 30 years? Can we look at some indicators of youth well-being over the same period? Are today's young people any more stressed than they used to be? Are they more depressed and anxious? Have we got any useful and robust evidence on this? There's lots talked about out there, but do we know? And depending on that, can we draw any implications on the link between those two and highlight some issues for adolescent welfare in the UK today. I don't have to point it at it, do I? So this is question one. There's a bit of social change there going on. In action. No mobile phones 30 years ago. Social change for young people in the UK over recent decades. That's my first one. And I'm going to be drawing in part on the Nuffield Foundation Changing Adolescence Programme, which is actually chaired for us by David Watson, so it was hence the link between me and Green Templeton, really, via David. This is a picture of our website. And the programme was funded by the trustees to look at questions of mental health and social change and the relationship with each other. Obviously, you can go to our website if you want a bit more information on the background. We picked six main themes to study. We could have picked others. I'm not going to talk about them all. But before I start, I want to acknowledge the invaluable work that was done for the Foundation by the people that we funded, one of whom is in the room here today. She's Frances Gargan. And I'm going to be drawing on work that... that they all did. So that includes on parenting, Francis, on time use, Professor Leon Feinstein and his team, which included some people from the US, substance use, Michael Gomor, and a team from the University of Manchester, neighbourhoods that I'm not actually going to talk about, stress, Sarah Sandberg, who's a child psychiatrist in London, and education, John Gray, and Maurice Fulton and their teams at the University of Cambridge. So, I want to... Oh, I can see it there. Oh, okay, that makes it a lot easier. I'm going to get us in the mood for a little bit of time travel now and start off... you can look at a few pictures in the 1970s, but I'll tell you a little bit about what was going on. This is where we've started. Somebody will undoubtedly ask me, why did we start in the 1970s? And I'm going to think of an answer to that. But it is the beginning of the time period that we looked at. And the 1970s were my decade. In fact, there's a couple of pictures of me on there. very old computer. So this is quite a personal story, because as you'll see later on, my children feature in one of the later decades. And I also wanted to thank Rhys, who gave a presentation in the panel I was on an excellent summary of some of the social policy issues that were arising in the 70s. Here in the UK, this was a decade of employment disputes. It was a decade of strikes. We had the Winter of Discontent in 1979. There was the election of Margaret Thatcher at the very end of the decade. Before that, we'd had quite a series of changes of government. Some social change being indicated by things like the Sex Discrimination Act in 1975, the Race Relations Act. It's funny for me now thinking that that is becoming history. If you think what it was like in the 20 years before that, it was quite remarkable progress up to this point. Anyway, it was a decade of expanding consumer power, and also of teenagers. So teenagers in this time were exposed to roller skates, chopper bikes, the invention of Monopoly, skateboards, the start of the punk music movement, the first Pan Am jet landed at Heathrow. So. Part of what I wanted to indicate by that was really quite what a lot of change these decades have witnessed. 1980s in the UK belonged to Margaret Thatcher, and there's lots of commentaries about the culture at the time, massive social change, we've got war, we've got disaster, we've got market changes, enormously important here, particularly to banking, commerce. But there were inventions, the World Wide Web, the first mobile phones in 1988. But during this decade, child poverty doubled, inequality increased between rich and poor here. Policies were designed to reduce public expenditure and taxation. Benefits and services for children were failing to keep pace with growth in the economy. So that's also something to bear in mind when we look at what was happening to young people over this period. Then we move on to the 1990s, which where we continued here with a Conservative government until 1997, shifts in international relations, but computers, Sony PlayStations, explosion of a completely different way of spending your time. And then we get to the late 1990s, and we have a marked shift in social policy, and Rhys highlighted this. So from 1997, when Labour came into power, we've got major efforts to improve social policy for children, commitment to eradicate child poverty. Minimum wage was introduced in 1999. Unemployment fell to 5%, which was the lowest it had been for decades. Sure Start interventions were rolled out, launched in 1998, rolled out in the early 2000s across the country. We appointed an independent children's commissioner, a minister for children, and there were improvements to parental leave and a big expansion of parenting programs. So we see quite a shift at the end of our period, and you'll see that we might want to talk about the significance of that a bit later. So that's a decade of my kids, a couple of them up there. Going to start by looking at some key areas of social change for adolescents, and I want to begin with time use. What you've got up there is actually just background. This is actually a piece of art, GCSE homework, where a 15-year-old has to write down everything they do all through the day. So this is what I mean by time use. That's why it's up there. It's probably better called daily activity patterns. It is, in some ways, lovely stuff, as for researchers. It's both a measurement of direct change. What were you doing, you know, what with, as a 16-year-old in 1970, what were you doing on a Thursday afternoon? And what is a 16-year-old doing this week on a Thursday afternoon? But it's also an index of more subtle underlying shifts in our social values and preoccupations. And children's time use, as this elements of this indicate, are arranged by these legal and statutory frameworks. You go to work, you get to school, you do what you have to do, the teacher tells you what to do, you go home, compulsory attendance at school, up to 16 here at the moment. And work on the significance of these sorts of activities, after-school programs, leisure activities, these sorts of things, come from a number of different literatures, a lot of it very American. We don't do too well in the UK on this. But people have looked at things like after-school programs, positive youth development, and the role of new media. Now, I'm going to show you some graphs that we put together. I'll put the first one up. On the basis of the work that was done for us by Leon Feinstein and also Jenny Simmons. And I want to take a minute to just explain these pictures, which we call the teeth diagrams, because they look like the x-ray you get when you go to the dentist. They're based on a similar picture drawn by Jake Oshuni on changes in working patterns over the same period, but it's not been done for adolescents before. And we made these from UK data in the multinational time use study, and the data have gone through this fantastically complicated matching process, sort of all nicely ironed out, not by us. But only the 1974 survey and the 2000 actually included diaries from young people, so that's what these data represent. So, at the top, you've got a picture. There's something that's gone wrong with this at the bottom here. But these are the times of the day. And you've got a pattern there which starts at the top with unstructured leisure, which is pink, and then you've got a layer of structured leisure. Then you've got the orange, which is media use, a fine light blue line, which is employment. Then you've got the purple, which is education. Green is travel. Domestic at the bottom, which is almost most things that you do at home, and then the blue is the sleep around the edges. Those are 11 to 15 year olds in 1974 and in 2000. There's not a great deal of difference. The one thing that stands out the first time I saw that, and in fact the foundation has funded some research on, is the loss of the school dinner hour. So there's a peak here where children go home, and it lasts quite a long time. And we don't have that anymore. In fact, the average length of the school lunchtime here is about half an hour now instead. There are, of course, large proportions in education at both times. There are bigger proportions in 2000, but it's not that dramatic. As a bit of a fall in domestic time, possibly, and not a great deal of time of change to leisure, so not a lot of difference. Then if we move on to the 16 to 18-year-olds, then you see a little bit more difference between these two patterns. So we've got a big drop in the proportion in work by 2000. So the education is by far the largest in work, smaller than the reverse was true previously. That's an increased proportion in education rather than increased hours. In fact, the hours in education drop slightly. We'll come to why that might be the case in a minute. And the biggest shifts here are actually in the middle income groups. So there's not a great deal of shift to the higher income groups. They already had a very high base of being in education.
big shift of middle-income groups out of work into education, and then a middling shift for the lower income. So a lot of this is likely to be about the loss of job opportunities rather than a desire to be in education. It will be a mixture of both. Put all of them together there to do a sort of have I got news for you picture quiz, which is the odd one out. And I think what this really my odd one out is the 1974-16 to 18-year-old over there. What this is a picture of extended adolescence. So in 1974, you're 11 to 15, your time is like that. You have quite a big shift. When you turn 16 to 18, life changed quite dramatically. We lost that. So go from 11 to 15 into 2000, the pattern is not dramatically different at all. So a 16 to 18 year old now looks more like an 11 to 15 year old did 30 years ago. I mean that in the nicest possible way. The other thing to note about this is the usefulness in the UK of those age periods. The 11. Is there a phone? Tyler Lane's chair.
It's not my phone.
Okay, just moving on quickly. Social change in education. Hint there in the Time Use data that something interesting happening in education. This is who's at school and what they are doing. This is a graph that was put together by Stephen Machin in London, and it's very actually extremely difficult to get this graph. An awful lot of mashing of stats has gone on to try and make a steady line out of this. But the top line is the proportion of people who are staying on in education. This is at age up to about age 16. And the bottom line are the qualifications, the number that are getting 5 GCSEs or the equivalent. So that reflects the graphs that we saw on Time Use. There's also a big gap at the end. A lot of kids staying on a school who are not getting 5 GCSEs. And I think that's a significant thing to bear in mind. So let's look in a little bit more detail at what goes on for the 16 to 18-year-olds. And these are some data on participation in education at the 16 to 18 age period and time change. We can't take it back as far as I would like. I don't have the data at the moment before 1985. But the numbers, obviously, the trend has been going in this direction. The previous 15 years, the numbers would have been even lower. And what you see is an increase in the number at maintained schools, but an increase too in the proportions who are in further education colleges, higher education colleges, a drop in part-time education, partly because of the labour force going, and apprenticeships and things, but an increase overall in the total who are in those different types of education. So this alerts us a little bit then to what might be going to happen 18 to 24 when we get a little bit higher up the scale here. What is this education for? And what are they doing in the further education colleges and higher education? Oh, I'm just going to skip that one actually. And I thought by the time I presented to you today we would have hit a million. In fact, we haven't quite, but we're very, very close to having a million people not in work, education or training in the 18 to 24 age period. So I think that what we are seeing is education as an alternative to doing anything else for certain groups of the population. And this is probably going to get worse, partly because, as you'll know from UK press reports, There was a massive pressure for an increase in university education to take some of these kids, essentially. But what has happened just recently is the rise in fees and now enormous pressure on spaces, which means that fewer education, I think, university places are available than were before. So some interesting trends going on there, and we'll come back to what they might mean in a little bit. But I'm going to move on now and do another bit of time travel through parenting. And that's a picture of a briefing paper that we put together on the basis of Professor Gardner's work for us on whether parenting had changed over time. There certainly has been lots of social change in this area. We have family formation, which is later and smaller than it used to be. So people are having fewer children, 84 children per 1,000 women in 1971, dropped to 56 by 2003. Age of first marriage goes up. Family type, less marriage, more variation in ways of arranging people in family groups. We've got 41% of children born to unmarried mothers by the early 2000s. We've got 80% of mothers of children aged 11 plus working by 2003, so an increase in maternal employment. And some hints that there's a change in family economic circumstances over this period, more inequality. That was particularly the case in the 1980s when we're talking about inequality, stabilised in the 90s. And if anything, slightly fell in the 2000s. So those are the sort of, in a sense, the ways in which family structures have changed and people are spending their time. But what Frances and her team did was took some indicators of parenting that have been shown to be important for children's outcomes, and looked at survey data from 1986, 16-year-olds, and 2006, 16-year-olds, what we've got there, and essentially asked the same questions. So of the children in 1986, parents ask who you're with, parents ask where you're going, parents ask what you're going to do when you get there. My parents expect me to go to school, to do my homework, to help in the house. And the interesting thing about this is the positive improvement. So for every one of those indicators, it's reported more positively in 2006 than it was in 1986. The differences are mostly small and the base is high to begin with. But all of this is a very positive picture of monitoring, supervision and control, and involvement and responsiveness by parents over this time period. And we quite like this story, because this is not what you necessarily get if you read the newspapers, parenting's all going to pot. These are the child's ratings. The results from the parents show the same trends, and so the sense that parenting of adolescents, if anything, is becoming warmer and firmer than it had been. Possibly hasn't affected all groups of parents in the same way, and this is slightly later dates from 1994 to 2005, looking at how many young people were out late after 9 o'clock without the parents knowing where they were, and the associations with lone parent status and poverty. And what you'll see there, the top line are the lone parents. So there were quite distinct differences in how supervised the children were in the lone parent groups. In the early 1990s, and lone parents, if anything, have worked harder. So their line has dropped right down to join that of the other groups by the time we get to 2006. Some hints in Frances' work that this has come at a cost. So we've got an increase in self-reported distress amongst parents across this time period, particularly for the low-income groups. So it's interesting to pull those results together with the thing that we've got about education and time use now, because that extended adolescence thing is playing in here too a bit. And one of our hypotheses about the stress that parents were feeling is partly that parenting goes on for a great deal longer now than it did 30 years ago. The average age of leaving home in the UK is about 23 now, and you'll get financial dependence all the way through to that. And when I was interviewing parents of young offenders in the 1980s, I was very struck speaking to their parents, an absolute conviction that children are done by 16 and they should be out of the house and they do not want to pay for them anymore. Well, there's almost a 10-year gap there where these children, if they're not being supported by their parents by now, they will have, will come back to the welfare issues. So, generally speaking, though, for parenting, the indicators are good. I don't have my... somebody's got a watch near to me. I don't have any. Okay, good. I should be halfway through, so that's... I think we're all right. I'm going to now just have a little look at some substance abuse trends.
This is per capita consumption of alcohol in Great Britain from 1956, actually, in this case, to 2006. These data are from the drinks industry. This is the way that young people use alcohol and substances has been a major feature of social change over, if not the 30 years, certainly the 40, 50 years that are covered in this graph, which is why we've included it in here. There's no reason to think those trends didn't apply as much to young people as they did to the rest of the population, but surprisingly, there are very few clear time data across the whole period for young people. Inferences are made from these population data, from studies on US high school students, where there seem to have been a number of surveys over the years, and from rises in criminal and hospital statistics relating to drug and alcohol-related problems. And in fact, for young people, the rises seem to have been steepest in the 60s and the 70s. Because of that, there was a lot of concern that we should be tracking what was going on, and several big international surveys were started in the 1980s. So particularly ESPAD, which is the European Schools Survey Project on Alcohol and Other Drugs, and the World Health Organization's Health Behaviour on School-Aged Children. But by the time the surveys began, the peak seems to have been passed. So those surveys don't actually track in detail what young people were doing. So we have a slight data gap in the middle where we don't quite know how this was rising and what sorts of behaviours that meant. But Jenny Simmons undertook some secondary data analysis for us of ESPAD, just to look at some of those more recent trends. I'll just show you this one, which shows in the 10 years or so that this covered, 12 years, the overall trend is down-ish, certainly in the UK. But as far as we can tell, the absolute levels in 2007 are still much higher than they were in the 1970s. Possibly some subgroups showing more serious alcohol abusing behaviour that may be showing some rises. The international dimension, of course, is interesting. The top line is the UK. The bottom line is the USA. You'll see the UK pretty much at the top line of any graph on adolescent alcohol and substance use. As well, this is being drunk one or more times. We also have the top lines for the earliest age that people get drunk and for binge drinking. But the overall trend, is not turning disastrous at the moment. If anything, it's going in the right direction. Drugs trends are not dissimilar, but they're lagged in time, so they're more recent. So the peak happened in the 80s rather than the 60s and 70s. Data are even more difficult to get hold of prior to these big surveys starting. But the best estimates that I could find were that in about 1987, anyway, in the mid-80s, we've got about 1 in 20 reporting ever having used an illicit drug, it's not alcohol. And by the mid-1990s, this was about 1 in 3. So we do have certainly increased experimentation. But the biggest proportion, the thing that the biggest proportion of the population using that alcohol, and that's part of why I've chosen to show you the alcohol graph and not the other drugs. So, it's on the next slide. Okay. My second question. So we've looked at some time trends in time use, education, parenting, and substance use, and there are some interesting and mixed patterns about some things getting worse, some things getting better, some things getting worse and then getting better. And I just want to spend a little bit of time now looking at trends in youth wellbeing and mental health over the same period. So our first graph is taken from some work done by Stefan Kolishaw, Barbara Morn and Robert Goodman for the Nuffield Foundation on the British birth cohorts, looking from the 1970s to the 1990s on age 16, these are parent ratings, of hyperactivity, emotional difficulties, anxiety and depression, and conduct behaviour, antisocial behaviour at the bottom. The Don't worry too much about what the numbers mean on the left-hand side. The important thing to look at are the trends there, and to remember the fact that these are symptoms. So these are not full-blown diagnoses. These are symptoms of anxiety and depression. And we particularly wanted for Stefan to look at ordinary, average things that a significant proportion of the population would experience. So not psychosis, not full-blown diagnostic categories. Other statistics from the later period, from the end of this time scale, suggest about 1 in 5 children aged between 15 and 16 have... That's the wrong statistic. I'm not going to repeat that because I think I've made a typo in there. So the clearest rises here are in the conduct scores and in the emotional problems from 1986 onwards. Hyperactivity is less clear. We asked Stefan to go on and look at what happened next. And so these are the trends into the mid-2000s, 2004. And interesting, you'll see here an easing off of those trends. And it's that links perhaps in with some of the trends that we've seen in possibly in the drug use and the conduct disorder. So there's a cause here for guarded optimism, but it still leaves young people today in the UK with a generally higher level of emotional and behavioural problems than their peers had in the 1970s. So a different way of looking at this and at well-being is stress. And something that people always say to us is, are young people more stressed than they used to be? Is that partly what this is all about? Stress is just the most difficult thing to define and measure and study. So early definitions of stress are about the automatic biological response to some type of external threat. Later definitions in the 80s, 70s and 80s emphasised the interaction between the mental state, nervous and immune systems, and the fact that you can't be stressed unless you interpret something as a stress. So stress has these two parts. It has the something that's happening to you, the stressor, and then it has your interpretation and your response and how and the resources that you bring. It's particularly salient in adolescence because there are some unique stressors, puberty being one, education, move to more independence and autonomy, identity formation, the formation of social hierarchies, extremely stressful, change is stressful, adolescence is defined by change. There's been some quite interesting experimental work showing that tasks that are uncontrollable and that have social evaluative elements are the most stressful things. Those are the sorts of tasks that were listed every other item on the piece of art homework, where somebody's evaluating you and it's social. There's some emerging evidence that adolescents respond differently to stress as well than in the second decade of life than we do at other times, partly because of the hormonal flux and brain development going on. So they have much more cortisol response. They get a bigger biological response to stress, more hypothalamus and pituitary and adrenal activity. But they report less. So if you measure biologically how much stress they're feeling, that's a much, much higher rating than, and then they will actually say, no, that's fine, I'm not feeling any stress. How do you know really what's going on? And this has been part of the problem in doing time research on stress. So there's quite a lot of research showing what adolescents feel stress about, generally speaking, it's things to do with school, it's friendships and peer relations, family and material resources, lack of things to do, job opportunities, less so perhaps romantic relationships and life transitions. But we do not have time data, reliable time data, trend data, on whether that has gone up. And even if somebody could give me the results of a survey from 1970 that said to people, how stressed do you feel? I don't know whether I would ever be confident that I was comparing like with like because of the social construction that goes on around stress. So this is it's extremely salient, but we just don't know whether it has increased. So try a different tack. Have a look at happiness and positive well-being. This is from an interesting paper on trends in child subjective well-being in the UK by Professor Jonathan Bradshaw and Antonia Kung, just been published in March this year. And they're using the British Household Panel survey data since 1994, which is as far back as these data go, to look at 11 to 15-year-olds and the extent to which they say they are happy. Well, they're getting happier. There's a significant gender difference, although it's small, and males are a little bit higher, gaps closing. Bit of an age difference. The younger age groups rate higher levels of happiness than the older ones. What Professor Bradshaw concluded was that you can't necessarily assume that because they're happier, they're not also more depressed. And that the trends are probably, they're not the two sides of the same coin. That it may just be something to do with emotional liability, it may be to do with how happy we feel reporting our emotions now. But even so, it's an interesting picture. I'm going to show you this has actually got nothing to do with trends. There are no trend data on this at all. But I think that people might find it interesting as a link with the happiness information, but also internationally and as a basis for some of the other things that you might hear about in the next day or two. So this is a snapshot of how we do internationally on something called the Child Wellbeing Index, which includes happiness. Subjective well-being is on there, but it also has these other domains of health, children's relationships, material resources, behaviour and risk, education, housing and environment. To some extent, I've been talking a bit about the education column there, a bit about behaviour and risk, and about subjective well-being, a bit about relationships. So we have been covering some of those topics. This is also from Jonathan Bradshaw's research at the University of York, covering 29 countries. This version is published by the Child Poverty Action Group. Top of the table you'll see is dominated by Scandinavian countries. No surprises there. So Sweden, Norway, Iceland, Finland and Denmark, all in the top six. And the bottom by Eastern European countries and the UK, 24th out of 29. So we do particularly badly on health, material resources and education. So we've got a mixed picture of what the trends look like in mental health and well-being and where we are at now. Some of the trends for mental health and well-being look not terribly good. We certainly have rises in emotional behavioural problems up until the 1980s, 1990s, but we do have some evidence that that's improving. Trends in happiness we don't have going back long enough, but it looks as if it's going in the right direction if those data are interpretable. Perhaps some particular problems in the UK on the end point on where we've got to in some of these domains. So have we got any evidence that these trends in emotional behavioural problems are related to any of the sort of structural time trends that I mentioned at the beginning? And I'm just going to go back to my four topics that we looked at to begin with and just give you a very quick run through. Evidence is not satisfactory. We were really surprised at the Nuffield Foundation at how little people had done to try and unpick, even map, let alone unpick, the trends in these areas. So there's very little that is conclusive. But there is a body of research that says time use matters. It says why it should be important. It's tended to focus on discretionary choices rather than structurally dominated choices. But it's to do with positive and negative reinforcement of behaviour. If you're surrounded by people encouraging you to develop positive behaviour, you've got more of your time filled up like that. That's going to be positive. Cognitive and skills gains, that comes particularly from some of the after-school research in the US. The contribution of time use to development of identity, to sense of mattering, again, comes a lot from the out-of-school activities work. The importance of socialisation and the transmission of inequality through time use, so the sorts of things that you're doing with your time can reinforce the situation you're in, whether that be positive or negative, and that's to do with constructive versus unconstructive activities. problem with time use research is that there are, of course, selection biases. People do choose how they spend their time, so people are choosing to do certain things. It's then hard to tie something causally onto that. But I would say that how people spend their time does matter for outcomes such as identity, socialisation, and positive behaviour. Whether that can be extended to mental health, we don't know. What matters about school and educational experiences? Well, the things that come out in the literature that matter are school effectiveness, which is related to achievements, and that's to do with the characteristics of the school, the way they're run and organised, clear focus for the teaching and the learning. Features of the classroom are as important as features of the school. You can have very good classes in a bad school and vice versa. School connectedness, how connected children feel to the school, if they feel they're part of something, the relationships they have with their teachers, positive emotional climate and belongingness related to less violence, drug use, dropping out. School transitions are related to anxiety and depression, only short term though, in the move as children go into to secondary school mostly. Very little research on the move at age 16. Significant group of children who do have trouble with the school transitions in the region of sort of 10% perhaps, but overall perhaps some indications for anxiety and depression there. But these areas, effectiveness, connectedness, transitions, that's not where we've seen the changes. If anything, the education changes in those areas have been positive. Where we could find any data on that, schools seem to have worked much harder at these elements than they had done previously. Where we have no information, but where the changes happen, are to do with the academic pressure. Is this a good thing or a bad thing? And I think we need to have a special interest in what is happening to those group of children who are staying on at school and are not getting their qualifications. So we've got around about 40% of kids who at age 16 in this country who don't get five GCSEs, which is our passport to the next stage of education. And there's just an absolute dearth of research about sort of nuanced and sophisticated research about what that does to children's views of themselves and what happens next to them when they go on to do whatever they do without their five GCSEs, which is some of the things that are going on in the colleges that we were looking at. So what matters about families, I'm not going to spend much about parenting. We think is unlikely to be a major explanatory factor in these trends because of those data that I showed you about parenting improving. Possibly some of the changes in structure of families have made some small impacts on rises in things like conduct disorder. I'm going to have to skim through quickly now. What matters about drugs? Lots matters about drugs. So there's a lot more that... that we could say about drugs because of the chemical aspects and the effects on the chemistry, the brain, specifically to the systems that are involved in controlling mood. Big overlaps, but that's a muddled picture, and it's a muddled picture to do with behaviour problems as well, and bi-directional relationships in there. But it is possible that some of those drugs... But the drug use stuff happened a bit too early, really. Well, the illegal substance is not, but the alcohol... possibly a bit early to be an explanatory factor for some of the mental health outcomes. So, some emerging themes. We're quite keen on myth-busting. We want to do a bit more of this. We want to sort of break down some of the expectations people have about time, what's happened and what's changed. Lots of things are actually much more positive than we might think that they were going to be. Some of the things that people don't seem to be paying a great deal of attention to might be more negative than people think they're going to be. I think there are huge implications about the changes in educational participation and the meaning for social and emotional consequences for young people. I think there's something particularly special about 16 to 18 year age group in this country, and we are unusual, I think, in the UK in providing the least structure for the most disadvantaged children in those age groups. The unemployment situation is going to get worse. The economic climate is, we're never going to have a youth labour market again. So there's a sort of fantasy going on that the government can somehow produce jobs for these people and it'll all be fine. Well, we can't. We've got to actually restructure society so that there is some purposeful activity for people up until the age of 25 that is not employment based. And nobody has really suggested to us any concrete ideas, social policy ideas in on that vein. I think we need to think more about peer groups. People are spending a lot more time in more intense peer groups because of that extended education. Good news on the parenting front. And also just a plea to think about adolescence separately and not just as part of a broader discussion about childhood. I think there are some particularly interesting things going on, as you'll have seen, in the 14 to 19 age group here. I think that's the end of the slides, yes. And scarcity affects all of those indicators. So something we can perhaps talk about in debate is what the effects might be in the next 10 years on some of those indicators. We know from really good American research, for instance, that economic scarcity has dramatic effects on parenting, and that's how it gets translated into effects on children. So even though there's been a lot of support for parenting, that might be something that we're going to have to do even more about. Obviously, there'll be even more effects on the educational opportunities. So recent social policy, as we sort of stated at the outset, has emphasised the reduction of child poverty, education and health inequalities and early intervention, and that is absolutely right. But we do need to make sure that we don't forget this older age group. And I'm just going to end with a quote, perhaps slightly surprisingly, from Florence Nightingale, 1893. I just spent some time this morning with a group doing some history stuff on nursing. And this is actually a plea for making sure we get multidisciplinary input across these domains, and we don't just think about education as education and parenting as parenting, but we think about how they all fit together into a big picture. And the quote was, what she wrote was, health is not only to be well, but to be able to use well every power we have to use. And I think the same can be said of you know, we can substitute mental health in there, we can substitute well-being, we can substitute welfare. It's not just about well-being, it's not just about making sure people are okay, it's about making sure that they can use all their resources in the best possible way, in a sort of purposeful life. And I think that we're going to struggle to do that with this age group and this. We push forward on some fronts in the UK in the next few years. Okay, that's it.